Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, capital budgeting. We're coming down to the end here, the grueling end, as it were, and it looks like chapters 12 and 13 are after this one, and then there's a special topics week, and after that, we're pretty much cruising in for the final exam. There will be, looks like, there are a total of 8 quizzes, so there will be 3 more before the end of the semester. I can't believe we're that close to the end now. Seems like it just was last week I impressed you for the first time, but here we go. I won't even bother to ask a good, bad day. This is a totally just a meh day. It's just sitting there looking stupid. I mean, the NASDAQ was up less than 0.25%, whoop-dee-doo. The Dow was up 0.17%, so there's nothing there. And the S&P was flat. Well, we got about an hour left on the market, but I don't see anything really exciting happening. Now, oil is finding its legs again. It's starting its move back up. And I don't think there's going to be any dramatic price increases in the next few weeks, but it'll slowly be trying to on average, work its way up to that next neckline there at 90 a barrel. As you can see, it's been working. It'll find it one of these days. But now the bonds, there was a sell-off in the bond market, of course, and that causes the price to go down and the yield to go up. Now, this isn't anything to write home about. There's nothing big here. That's 0.1%. That's a 1 basis point rise, and that's nothing worrisome there. The concern still is from everyone I talk to, there's this almost inevitable, there's this resigned to the inevitable. Inflation is coming, it's going to be a serious inflation, and it probably will start to really be noticeable around the Christmas season as the demand goes up for buying. And although I do have to say that there's a lot of expectation that this will be a good, strong Christmas season for sales, and that's going to help us crawl out of this kind of doldrums we're in right now. But as far as other markets go, London was having a pretty strong day, up 0.75% almost. And the Nikkei just had a really big surge day. And I don't know what that was about. I wasn't following the Asian markets all that closely overnight. But apparently, they're happy in Japan about something. The current issues with their new prime minister, I believe his name is Kishida, they seem to be pretty much getting used to the fact that he's going to be a good rule. He's going to be a good leader and all that kind of stuff. So that stability of the political environment is really important in long term with financial markets, especially in Asia, even here to some extent, but not as much. Well, look at that. The S&P 500 has actually gained 0.01%. Whoop-tee-doo. That's 43 cents. It has risen. Yeah, this is just a doldrums day. There's just nothing motivating the markets, getting the markets excited at all. We are in record territory for what that's worth. Now, always remember that when we talk about, well, this is a record high, you have to take that in that's in nominal terms. Does that mean that it is a record high adjusting for inflation over the many, many years that the stock markets have been traded? The answer is no. So if we say it's a record high, well, that's a record high, not adjusting for the loss of purchasing power that happens over time with inflation and all that. Enough of that. I was trying to think, there was something I was going to talk to you about. I know what it was, but I'm going to have to take that, do that on a separate day. Now, see this calculator that I've got up here, this virtual TI? This is your friend for what we're doing today. It's capital, and on Wednesday, it's capital budgeting. And I'll tell you, and I don't want to sound like a broken record doing this, but when we did these back years ago, we did have, there were financial calculators at the time, but they were really expensive, and no professor was going to let you use a financial calculator. I mean, even the most progressive, liberal, technologically sophisticated professors would have had a fit if they'd seen someone using a financial calculator, which I actually finally got sick of. And I think 1984, I finally got myself this really heavy duty. It was an HP 12C financial calculator. And they're still around, and I still have that one, and it still works, and it's still just great. But the point I'm trying to get to is we did this by tables and by hand calculations for the most part. And, man, this was a pain in the backside doing these. This TI-83 can just do these like lightning. Now, this will be great for this week's subject, capital budgeting. And in fact, most people who do capital budgeting, if they're just doing quick analysis, they'll use a calculator. They'll probably use a TI-83 or 84. Now, the next week, that is where we get into cash flow analysis, free cash flow analysis, valuing companies. That's more something you want to do with Excel. So make sure that you have Excel with you. Whether or not you know Excel, we're going to use some mad Excel skills to do the capital budgeting, because it works so much faster if you do it that way than if you try to do it on a calculator or especially by hand. Okay, here it goes. I'm not back anymore. The hell with this. Okay. Okay. Madam, have you ever wanted to... You saw someone who was so happy and so joyful that you just wanted to crush that person's hopes and dreams and ruin his or her day? Probably not. You're not an old grouch like I am. Okay. But here's the thing, is that in any kind of an enterprise, or in any part of your life, you're going to have to decide whether something is worth doing or not doing. Now, in our daily lives, we make decisions on the fly, and they're somewhat, in some cases, they're rash and unscientific. When we're in business, or actually in about any field of endeavor, we have to use the best practices. We use numbers and data and science and equations to the extent humanly possible. Because our competitors are going to do it that way, and they're going to have a lot more accuracy in their results than we will if we do it by the seat of the pants. When I was doing consulting back in the 1980s and 90s, you still had a lot of entrepreneurial types who did not want to do things by the numbers. They didn't want to use what I'm teaching you here. They wanted to do it, well, I just have a feeling this is going to work. Or, no, nah, I don't want to do that because I just don't get a good gut feeling about it. Well, sometimes they're good about that. They might be right, but we can't do that here. We have to do the best practices. Here's how we do it in real life. And so if you've got a good idea, you got a great idea, you have to go through me. And I'm the finance person, and you assume that I am just an old bitch. I'm going to say, nope. Probably I'm going to be grumpy cat. No. And you have to really convince me that the project is worth doing. This could be an industrial factory. We want to put up this new factory to build these cars. What kind of cars? Electric cars. Well, what's your advantage? Why do you think you can build electric cars? Because I'm the president of the company and I smoke pot until my face swells up. Oh, okay. We'll put $1 billion into your company. Or you say, well, you know, we really should make this new division of our company for products that we haven't even thought of making yet, but now we're going to make them. Okay. You might be a marketing person, okay? And you've got a campaign, and you think that this is going to generate a lot of revenue. And it's going to boost the product that you have in mind. It's an ad campaign. You see, in all of these, money is going to be spent. And you are proposing that the reason you're going to spend the money is because it's going to bring in money more than you spent. Okay, so, long, long time ago. Okay, I'm going to show you three distinct methods for capital budgeting, for deciding whether a project is up or down. Now, two of these are strong. They're best practices. They're what we do now in big companies and in medium-sized companies. One of them, it's what we're supposed to do. It's scientifically sound, and it follows the rules of finance, the rules of physics, the rules of the universe. Now, there's one method. It's really old. The third method is really old. From my readings, especially when I was a specialist in old, middle, and early modern languages and literature, you would see business decisions were obviously being made all through human history and probably even before what we call the Homo sapiens sapiens we are now. Probably there were business decisions being made by our predecessors, the Neanderthals. We have evidence of production in their societies as well. They had to decide yes or no. Now, from what I can tell, this method, the old method, was, I can track back the logic of it, how they, this way of saying yes or no, at least into the 1400s. Probably prior to that, it was used. I would strongly suspect that it was one of those residual wisdoms from the Romans and the Greeks. But it was called the payback period method. And what it essentially said was, okay, if we are going to spend $1,000, we need a limit on how long it will take this project to get us back our $1,000. Let me say that again. If we need $1,000 to get this project started, then we have to have some time limit on how long it will take to get back that $1,000. Okay, so we spend $1,000, and first year, $200, second year, $500, third year, $300, fourth year, $200. Then the payback period would be about 3.5 years. Okay, now then we have to apply some rule within our company or within our enterprise. We don't take projects that don't pay back within 3 years. And so you would reject that project. Now therein lies one of the biggest weaknesses in this payback period method is that it is an arbitrary number. I mean, it could be, someone could say 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. It's just completely pulled out of the backside. Now that's not to say that the other method, one of the better methods, doesn't do something sort of like this too, but pull some number out of thin air. But I was consulting for companies when I started in the 1980s. First three companies that I did, they were using payback period method. They just would say, well, okay, we've got this all figured out. I'd come in, I'd say, all right, how did you do this capital budget? Well, this one's going to cost $375,000, and our projections say that we will get that back within 5 years, and our payback period is 7 years, so it's a go. And I was a little bit surprised because the first company, the guy was an MBA from an Ivy League school. I said, you're using payback period method? He said, well, yeah, what else is there? Of course you use that. Okay, second company, payback period, and theirs was 3 years. And then the last company, I don't remember what it was. It was something like 3-4 years. But it was just, that was the way they did it. They just pulled a number out of thin air, and they said, we won't take a project if it pays back in longer than our year rule. Okay, now, I'm going to show you more about that payback period method, but just briefly, here's the upshot. The three methods are the payback period method and a couple of variations on it. The second is the net present value method. And the third method is the internal rate of return method. This is the old method. It has actually another flaw. Let me do this. Year zero, year one, year two. In year zero, the free cash flow from a project is negative $10,000. Then in year one, it's positive $2,000. In year two, it's positive $3,000. In year three, it's positive $4,000. In year five, it's positive $5,000. And then in year six, it's positive $3,000. And I'll ignore salvage value. I will talk about that in a little bit. Now, the payback period method would say, okay, we've got at year one, we've got still negative 8,000. At year two, we've shaved off and now we're down 5,000. Year three, we're down 1,000. And year four, we're up 4,000. And year five, we're up 7,000. So your payback period here is between 3 and 4 years, and you can do this spline thing where it's 10,000 and 4,000. So where is zero between 10,000 and 4,000? Well, that's at about two-thirds of the way. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Oh, no, it's 1,000, 4,000. So you break to zero 1/5 of the way. So it's 3.2 years is the break point. 3.2 years is the payback period. Okay, now suppose, yeah, go ahead.
Can you explain how you...
I pulled that one out of air. But okay, look. You do 1,000 and 4,000, okay? So zero is a total of 5,000. So 1,000 to break to zero, 1,000 of 5,000. Do you see how there's a $5,000 gap right here? And we need to jump 1,000 to get to zero. So I jump 1,000 of 5,000. 1 over 5 is 0.2, so it's 3.2 years. Technically, the fancy name for that is a linear spline. In other words, you find the one-fifth of the way. See, it's one-fifth. I need to go one-fifth of the distance from negative 1,000 to 4,000. So one-fifth of 5,000 is 0.2. That's how you do it. I mean, honestly, I hate to say this, but I just do that one in my head, which is dangerous considering how bad I am at arithmetic. But here's the thing is, suppose that they said, well, our payback period is 3 years. Then you say, no, because it's going to take 3.2 years. Okay? What if you say your payback period is 4 years? You say yes. You see, it's completely arbitrary. And like I said, it's just all over the place. Now, the other really bad thing about this is that it doesn't take into account the present values. Those numbers down the line there, they are not comparable to the number at the zero mark. So that $2,000, comparing that to the $10,000 at year zero is not right. You should say $2,000 discounted back 1 year. What's the present value of $2,000 discounted back a year? What's the present value of $3,000 discounted back 2 years? What's the present value of $4,000 discounted back 3 years? It's not taking into account the time value of money. So that's a deep flaw. Now, one version of the payback period method takes the present values of those numbers to do that run there. It still fails because it's completely capricious. How many years you make your decision for? See, one of the problems that will happen with the payback period method, especially in more modern times, is that the payback periods have gotten shorter because they want only the projects that will pay off real fast, the quick payoff projects. So they're not looking at, they completely push away the projects that are long haulers that take a long time to develop with the payback period method. Now, here's what kind of blew me away. The payback period method is just not reasonable to use in the modern world. Obviously, when they were using it in the 1500s to decide whether they were going to send ships to explore this new world or that place, yeah, it was reasonable to do it back then because they didn't have another method. But now we know what is flawed about the method, and we've got much better, more scientific ways to do it, using present values and time values of money and all that. Here's the problem, though. There was a survey done. I got to be careful because we've been in quarantine, so I've lost track of time. I think it was done in 2016. It was done by Barron's, and it was Forbes. And what they did was they surveyed just like 500 big companies, and they said, which method do you use? And it was sort of to inform us in academia how much we needed to emphasize these, or if this was being, if we still had a lot of road to go, or if the companies were embracing the best practices methods. Turned out that over half of the companies said they're still using payback period. Over half of the companies are still using payback period. That was about 5 years ago. That's just jaw-dropping that many companies are still using a flawed method, not even caring. This is the charge that we give to you. And when we bring you here, we teach you those methods that are at the frontier so that as you go, and I've said this before to you, you are the shock troops. You got to go out there and fix the world, for God's sake. Now, you're not going to be able to do it right away. When you go into a company and they say, well, we're going to use the payback period method, you say, yes, evil master. And you wait your time until you can get hold of the reins of power and change it. And unfortunately, a lot of times, you'll sit there for 10 years watching people using methods that are outdated and antiquated because nothing is stopping them from changing. That's one of the things that happens. Oftentimes, corporations really have to sometimes just get slapped back and forth with terrible losses of money before they get a clue that the old methods are no longer going to be acceptable anymore. That's what's happening right now in corporate America, in politics. Old style, the discriminatory policies. Yeah, you were quite happy using them. Now you're going to find out it's costing like hell to keep doing that. And the same thing is true in these more technical mathematical subjects. you're going to have to come to the point where you realize it's costing you a fortune to keep using the methods that are not best practices. You're just going to have to suffer the consequences until you finally say, what are we doing wrong? And then you guys step up, well, let me show you what they taught us. And then they'll see. Here's the thing, though. Net present value and internal rate of return. The problem with these methods is that one is actually superior to the other. But the one that is less superior was second on the list of the methods used by corporations. And it was just like, really? Here's the thing. This is, just don't do it. These two, yeah, but this one has two flaws in it that are a little bit of a problem. Now, we can fix the one flaw, but the other flaw is similar to a problem with the payback period method. The internal rate of return method is very popular, and you can see why when you see it in action. And yet, there's an arbitrary part to it, where you pull a number out of thin air. The net present value method is the strongest of all the methods. Unfortunately, it requires a little more work in practice. Okay. The net present value method would say, okay, let's take the net present value, and I'm going to write this as a mathematical equation. And the main reason I'm going to do this is because it makes you look, your notes look really badass. The net present value is the sum from t equals 0 to n of the free cash flow at time t times 1 plus the discount rate of the project to the negative t power. In other words, it's the present value of all the future cash flows. Now, you can break this up and say this is the free cash flow at period 0, the initial investment, if you want to put it this way, which is the negative. Plus the sum from t equals 1 to n of the positive free cash flow. This is a negative number, and the first one was. And then free cash flow time t times 1 plus r to the negative t. And this would be the free cash inflows arising from the project. And these are these are positive, but I put under here a little caution. Usually they're positive. They usually positive. Now, you see, because sometimes projects actually, you have your initial cash outflow, what you put out. And then you say, okay, here comes the money, the revenues from it. Sometimes there's a place where you have to upgrade. As a matter of fact, I had one project that it was a small thing, but they already knew that they were going to put money in. It was about $70,000. And then they were going to have 2 years of positive free cash flow. But what they were going to do was they were going to use that time to ask to survey customers who use the product. They didn't want to use focus groups because that was going to cost a lot. Just to try talk to customers and to see what regions of the country their product was going to sell in the most so that they could realign the distribution chains, and then that was going to cost some money. So in the third year, there would be a negative free cash flow. They'd still be getting revenue in, but they were also going to spend a lot of money to get everything lined for the long run. And then, of course, after that, positive free cash flows started flowing again. So it's usually positive, and that one I gave you there, yeah. Here's the interesting thing, though. The net present value method is a very simple decision method. Because if, see that NPV? If it's positive, you accept the project. If it's negative, you reject the project. If it's positive, you accept. If it's negative, you reject. It just drops to a very simple, it's a binary solution. Yes or no. And I can guarantee you that is going to really honk off the people who busted their butts to get a project all put together, get our numbers for us, the free cash flows, the depreciation schedules, the revenue estimates, demographic, all that kind of stuff. And then you say, okay, we got it. 5 minutes later, we just put it in the calculator. It's no. Oh, my God. Yay. We just spent 6 months on this marketing campaign and got all of the numbers together for you. And you come back, in literally in one case, an hour and a half later, and you're telling us no. Well, yes, no. Oh, geez, the hell it broke loose. But okay, that's all there is to it, though. You see, in a way, that's trivializing the great work that was put in by the marketing people and all of this. But in the other way, it just drove it down to a simple result. What you've got to watch out for, now I'm going to talk about this in more detail in a little bit here. But here's the problem. Here's where the difficulty comes in. Is because in order to do this, you have to have a discount rate for the free cash flows. Now, the riskier the project, the higher that discount rate's going to be. Greater risk, greater expected return. The issue here is, how do you get that discount rate? The one thing you probably don't want to do, okay, wrong way, number one, discount rate. And I just draw like this. Pull it out of your butt. No. Don't. Method two. Use CAPM. Yes. In other words, the expected return to this project is going to equal the risk-free rate plus the beta of the project times expected return to the market portfolio minus the discount rate. That's how you should do it. The problem is the beta. What do you do for the beta? Comps. Guarantee you, comps. Find comparable. Find a company that does this project. Look, find its beta. That's how you do it. Find a bunch of companies that do projects similar to this. Take the average of their betas. Do it with Standard & Poor's. They've got all this data. Just say find comps for a product like this. Three. How's that always done? How is it usually done? WAC, weighted average cost of capital. Is that good? Absolutely friggin' not. I won't mention where it was, but there was a seminar where this professor was bragging about this case study he was doing with his advanced finance students, undergrads. And he said, well, you know, it was a capital budgeting project, figuring out whether a real-life project was go or no-go on a real company that had done this and provided all the information. And the students were supposed to find that the financial analysis had made a terrible mistake, which they did, because they had miscalculated the weighted average cost of capital. Straight up, just an arithmetic error. And so the project was accepted, I believe, but it should have been rejected because the weighted average cost of capital that they had calculated was wrong. And the students were supposed to find that, notice that they had made a mistake in the original actual company. No mention was made of the fact that weighted average cost of capital is not a good way to use, not a good thing to use. Okay. Weighted average cost of capital is everyone in this room, okay? But then we look at an individual person. Almost never are you going to find an individual in a sample that is exactly the average. Almost never will you, especially in a smaller sample. So you've got a company that might be an amalgamation of, let's say, 20 projects, 30 projects. That's this company, all of its different projects. Okay. So the weighted average cost of capital is the cost of capital for debt and equity that finance all of these projects. Well, what if this project that you're taking on now is much riskier than the normal project that you take on? Or what if this project is much safer than the normal project you take on? The weighted average cost of capital is by no means the way that you should assess the discount rate, because that is the overall average. Now, if you've got a company, now here's an interesting idea too, is that the older a company gets, the less likely it is to take on really dangerous new projects. In some industries, that's not true at all, like military industrial companies. But overall, as a company gets older, it tends to take on less crazy projects. Now, you, sir, at your age, you will take on projects like going to a grindcore concert and diving into a mosh pit, wearing Tabasco sauce all over yourself. When you're 50 years old, you're not going to do that. If you do, you're going to embarrass the hell out of your kids. See, as company gets older, it's not going to get as risky. So if you've got a company that's older and it's got a weighted average cost of capital, that's probably a weighted average cost of capital across projects that have, when the company was young and more of a risk-taking company, when the company was middle-aged and it was still taking risks but not as many. So the thing, though, is that that weighted average cost of capital for your latest project, which is probably going to be something relatively safe, you don't want to do that at the weighted average cost of capital, because that includes projects that were riskier when the company was younger. So that is not a good method, but it is the most popular way to get a discount rate for the NPV method. Again, WAC is the most popular way to get a discount rate for the NPV method. Now, in my when I did consulting, I said, look, it's not that much harder to just do a quick CAPM instead of just running to the treasury people and say, what's our WAC? And they tell it to you, okay, we'll use that. Why don't you just take the extra 20 minutes to get the beta for the project and do the CAPM to get a real accurate assessment of the interest rate, discount rate associated with the risk of this project. But whatever. One way or the other. Okay, but anyway, here. Now, we're going to do this the easy, I don't know, maybe you guys want to do it the hard way. No, you don't. See, what I would have to do is if I did it the hard way, the net present value, let's say that our discount rate is 12%. The net present value would be negative $10,000 plus $2,000 discounted back one period plus 3,000, discounted back at 12%, two periods, plus 4,000, discounted back three periods, plus 5,000, discounted back four periods, plus 3,000, discounted back five periods. Add all those up, and there's your Uncle Bob. So why don't we do this the easy way? Turn on the calculator. I'm actually going through now, on an average day, 8 masks because I drool so much. Excuse me while I get a clean mask on here. Okay. Apps, finance, NPV solver. NPV. It takes you back to the main screen. First thing you put in is the discount rate, 12. Make sure you know this is an app, so you just put in the percentage. Comma. Now you get to put in an actual negative number. And use the negative sign. Don't be lazy. Negative. What was it, 10 grand? Comma. Okay, here come the free cash flows, the positives. And they don't have to be positives, like I said sometimes. But anyway, we'll crank through it. 2,000, comma, 3,000, comma, 4,000, comma, 5,000, comma, 3,000. Close the braces. Okay, calculator, that's the end of the positives. Close the parenthesis, and there's your Uncle Bob. That can't be right. I made a mistake. There it is. I see it. I put in a 50 instead of a 5. There it is, right there. By the way, if you don't know what I did there, I hit second enter, and that takes you into edit mode, if you hadn't noticed that. Okay. Well, it's positive NPV. At 12%, the NPV is positive $1,904. And then suddenly, you are the treasury assistant. And you run in, stop, stop, you stupid fat boy. No, it was supposed to be 18%. And I said, I thought you said 12%. She said, no, you're just hard of hearing, fool. You're old. So I said, okay, fine. I'll go back. Second edit, and I'll fix it. 18. Whoa. Well, that was close. We're still positive, but it's just 174. What would have happened if I'd put 20% in there? Second, edit. Ouch. We would have rejected the project at negative $318. You notice the pattern? As the discount rate went up, the NPV was going down, somewhere between 18% and 20%. The NPV line crossed. See that line right there? Now, we used to do these on graph paper, you know, that engineering graph paper with a mechanical pencil, so that we could actually identify that strike point there. That point where it switches from positive to negative is the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. See? The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. One more time. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. Now, technically, we were supposed to keep trying 18.2, 18.8, and working back and forth until we got it to two decimal places of accuracy. That was how they wanted us to do it. And of course, like I said, we figured that out real fast. You get really good graphing paper, and you graph really carefully with the way we used to in the engineering and mechanical pencils and all that, and we could get it down easily to two decimal places. And of course, the professors knew that we were doing it that way, so it was all good. Here's what's interesting, though. Watch this. See what I can do here? I can say, let me edit this. And I'm going to come back up here, and I'm going to replace that NPV with another function. Apps, finance. If you go down to 8, that's internal rate of return. Absolutely important that you see what I'm going to do now. The internal rate of return, you don't give it a discount rate. It finds the discount rate. So I need to delete from the NPV function, I need to delete the discount rate and the comma. That's really all you have to do. If you're going to do the, why would I key in the information again if I can just edit the function, replace NPV with IRR, and delete the discount rate? Again, you don't need the discount rate because that's what the internal rate of return is going to tell you. Now, if I'm looking at that right, I'm thinking that it's probably around 18.5. That was a terrible graph. But let's see. Oh, not bad, 18.69. So in other words, that is the discount rate. If I put that in the NPV, that 18.6903.7892, I would have gotten exactly a zero net present value. Right there, that again, that's a net present value. It's called the NPV profile. Every project has its own NPV profile. Now, it can be a shallower line, it can be a steep line. It's all characteristic of the project itself. It was kind of curious. One of my strange little, I don't know if you call it a fetish, but when I was doing consulting, I looked forward to having a project that I would evaluate so I could see if there was anything about types of projects that was kind of gave me an indication of the behavior of the NPV profile line. Didn't really see much, but the thing here, though, is that, you see, suppose that let's try this. Okay. Imagine, sir, that you were the assistant to the Treasury head. And I come in and I say, okay, here are the free cash flows there. 10,000, 2,000, 3,000. And I'll give you the discount rate tomorrow. Okay? So tomorrow, and you come in, I come in and I say, the discount rate is 9.6%. You say, reject it. I said, what? How did you know that? Didn't you, do you need to do it on the calculator, please? I don't need to. Because you see, you had the cash flows, the positive free cash flows. I gave you those yesterday. And you found that the net you didn't know what the shape looked like, but you know you ran the internal rate of return and you found out that the project strikes zero at 6.2%. So when I told you 9.6%, you didn't have to do anything, you just said reject. Do you see why? Because at 9.6%, the NPV profile line is negative. Let me say that again. All I did was give you the numbers. I didn't give you the discount rate. So you couldn't find an NPV. But you could key it in as an internal rate of return problem because that doesn't need a discount rate. And when you did that, the number that spit back out at you was 6.2%. I'm sorry. It was the number that you got was 9.6%. So you knew that at the discount rate of 6.2%, it was going to be negative. I think I said that wrong. But we'll do that. We'll do it again. I want to get you to the point where you're comfortable with doing these. But before I go any further with this part of it, as much as we should be using numbers by scientifically valid reasoning behind them and all of that, it also has to be with the backing of the narrative that's going on. Whenever we do any kind of a project analysis, yeah.
So you say if it's greater than, if it's less than that value, you accept it. But if it's greater than that value,
that's right. If I give you,
if it's exactly zero,
then you are indifferent. This is the famous. You're completely indifferent to it. At the end of the day, what we're doing, see, you needed to have me teach you economics. I was an economics teacher for so many years, as well as finance and math and English and all that. But there's something in economics that you should have been taught the difference between accounting profit and economic profit. We talk about it in this class too. See, economic profit covers all of your costs of normal accounting, but it also gives you a sufficient return to the entrepreneurial skill for the risk that you took. So in that donut example that was early in the course, you made $20,000 in the donut shop. Well, that's great, but that did not cover the risk that you took by doing that instead of something else. So when we do these NPVs, using those discount rates are taking into account the risk of the entrepreneurial skill involved. So this goes to the heart of the question that are being you're asking, is at zero, you're going to make an accounting profit. But you're going to make only exactly enough to cover your risk as well. A positive NPV project means you're making more than the risk of the project. You're making an economic profit. Now, there's the first question. Great, I can seek into that. The question comes up, why did this project, look at a project, and you find that it has a positive NPV. One question you should ask yourself is, why does that project have a positive NPV? Well, hey, it's a great idea. And then you say, again, why does that project have a positive NPV? Is the whole rest of the world that stupid that they haven't seen this? That there's no entrepreneur, no corporation on planet Earth has ever seen anything contemplated this and already taken advantage of this project? And so when we go in, we're going to end up having our prices being driven down by the competitor that's already there, that already figured this out. You've got to have a really good reason why a project should have a positive NPV in a world of sharks, in a world of greedy people, greedy corporations, greedy countries that will gobble up anything that is possibly worth a buck. How did you become so special that you figured out that this is positive NPV and no one else ever has? See, that's a harsh question, but you always have to ask yourself, why me? I don't know. But if it's a perfect zero, that means you're going to make, you should see, at best, projects that are zero NPV. They're worth doing. You're going to make exactly as much as the risk that you took on. But if you see, well, this project has a net present value that's $500 million, wow, aren't we incredible that we discovered this and no one on Earth ever has before us? Probably not. Now, that does not mean that they aren't out there. But don't think it's just magic. Everything I touch is gold. No, most of you are not as lucky as that, and neither am I. Let me bring up a word here, though. Everything we're doing here has to do with incremental cash flows. Incremental. The extra, the marginal. We look at projects in sandboxes. To the extent that we possibly can, we don't let ourselves be deluded into thinking that our project should be looked at in the broader context of the corporation itself. That should not be the way we look at projects. This project is as if it is its own company. It has no effect on the revenues of anything else, and it doesn't have anything to do with our other projects. In other words, we sandbox. We look at what extra revenues will this make for us, and what extra costs will this incur upon us. And God, you've got to watch out for those costs. Opportunity cost is the one that blindsides so many corporations. Well, we're moving you from that project over here over to this one, so there's no cost of you. Oh, yes, there is. It's his salary. You're giving him up on that project to put him on this. Yes, he is a cost. Well, we got this land, and it hasn't been doing anything, so it's not going to be a cost for this. Oh, yes, it is. Just because you were too lazy to use that land or to sell it doesn't mean that it's not a cost. Okay, so you've got to watch out for opportunity costs. You've got to watch out for incrementalism. You want it to be only the extra. I got something in my mind I got to bring up, but I got to bring up something else first here. Okay. Now, there are times when you can argue for a bleed out from incrementalism. In other words, there are some times when one project will affect the larger company. There are a couple of different situations. One is a positive called synergism. Synergies. In other words, one project is going to feed another project. So you have to look at its effect because it really is feeding another project. You really don't want that unless you want that. Let me explain what that means. In some cases, I will build a product to lose money on it. Simply because I'm going to make a fortune off another product that needs it. That's why I will give away printers with your computers. I'll sell you a really pretty printer for $30. Why? Because I'm going to tear you apart for the rest of your miserable lives on those stupid inks. Every time you try to run the, black and white, I'm sorry, you're out of green. Why green? Because we use green in the black. They're going to just milk you for the rest of your miserable life. They will give me my blood monitors. Why? Because they are going to make their money off the Lancets, the alcohol pads, the meal plans. You see, because diabetes isn't a disease, it's a lifestyle, and they're going to sell you your lifestyle and make you feel special, just like they do with a lot of the illnesses we have now. It's not the illness, it's the lifestyle that is making them the money. So they'll give you a lot of free stuff because they're going to make money for the rest of your life. You see, a single element sale is not nearly as valuable as a cash flow. That's why Adobe screwed everyone over. They don't sell their Photoshop and their After Effects anymore. Why should they do that when they can force you to have a subscription for the rest of your life? They've got you. Well, I'm not going to pay that anymore. Well, then you don't get to use all your pretty Photoshop pictures and your pretty neat After Effects stuff. I'm sorry. You're stuck. You see, they moved the risk from them of the cash to you by taking away the shrink wrap and selling you the subscription. Hence what's going to happen with Windows very soon. What's going to happen with Macs, with the iOS or the iMac and all that. Okay. However, synergies are there. You just can't say, well, this is going to help all of our products. Usually, you want to keep products as separate as you possibly can. Here's what I mean by that. Look at car companies. Car companies are famous for what's called demographic tracking. I'll give you an example, Toyota. Years ago, there was this cute little sort of like a baby version of an SUV, a four-seater, really a sporty, cute little thing for the 20-something crowd. They called it the RAV4. Look at a RAV4 now. It's a big-ass SUV for mom and dad and five kids and the dog. They will track you. See, what they'll do is they will make sure that you're stuck with, let's say, the one Nissan. What was the Nissan? The lowest low-end one they used to have. I can't remember what it's called now. But they follow you up your demographic line. And they keep building that one up so that when they do bring in a new one, it comes under that, and that one will not cut off the sales to this one because these sales have been tracking you as you get older. So this picks up the next wave of the demographic echoes and carries it up, getting better and better, and then one comes in under that. The one that amazed me was the Camry. It started out not that fancy. Got fancier and luxury and fancier and luxury. And all of a sudden, if you look at the Camrys that are on the road now, they're sporty. They're like a freaking sports car. That's right. They tracked the men up until those men went through male menopause. Kid you not. I mean, it's brilliant way the companies are playing this. Target, it has been holding the demographic of the college student for a long time successfully. But then they upgraded their stores so that they could track those kids coming out of college into their later 20s with the groceries that are prepackaged for making meals, for slightly nicer furniture, somewhat better clothing that would be used by the business casual community of the 25 to 35 crowd. So synergies, sometimes you want them, but most of the time you do not want your products interfering with each other. Now the other part of that is, the other side of it is what is called cannibalism. You want to make sure that your products are not eating each other's revenues. So cannibalism is in there. Just keep an eye out for cannibalism. Ask yourself, is this going to take away sales of something we already have? That's the other side of what I was talking about. So this whole thing about project analysis isn't just numbers. Well, it is numbers always, but you have to think logically about your products. What are they going to do to each other? When is it time to let a project go, too? One thing that is a bad idea is to think that projects are going to go on forever. They are not. And so make your projects have a timeline. Now, here's the last part of that. Salvage value. At the end of a project's life, you're going to see in the problems I give you, and in year six, the company generated a final $4,000 in revenue and with a salvage value of $3,000. Now, if I ever tell you a salvage value, it goes on the last year's cash flow. It adds to it, okay? Again, if I say there's a salvage value, just add it to the last year's revenue, normal cash flows. Now, salvage value is way too often ignored. I'm going to tell you a secret, okay? Please don't tell anyone this. There's a big room down in the basement here. That's where we keep dead students. I won't let them do that to you, okay? We'll put you up there. There's a freezer up. You know, it's a walk-in for meat, but, you know, you'll be good there, too. Bring you out at Halloween, scare the crap out of the new kids. Okay. No, there's down the basement. This was like 4 years ago. No, it was more than that. They wanted me to do a photo shoot of all the different staff members in the College of Business. And I said, well, I'm going to have to get someplace, get my studio lights and all this. Oh, we got a huge room. I said, where? And they showed me this ginormous room down there that I'd never seen. No one, hardly anyone ever knew about it. Only a few people have the keys. I went in there. There were computers. And I'm talking about computers that you would not even recognize as computers. They had these computers with these ginormous monitors that weighed 400 pounds. They had floppy drives that took not the little diskettes, not the 5.5, they took the 8-inch. Whoa, whoa. They had hard drives that would cost a fortune. One of them was an unbelievable beauty. It was a 10-megabyte hard drive, and it was as big as this. You see what they were doing? They were not selling the stuff that they had. Now, the next part of it, salvage value can be negative. And that's a big thing, too. Because the worst thing in the world is what's happening right now, and you're going to be dealing with it in your lives, in your corporate lives, environmental remediation. You would not believe what needs environmental remediation. And no, your company should not try to do it itself. It should not just pretend that it isn't there, because the liability tail will bite you in the ass 20 years later with hundreds of millions of dollars in class action lawsuits from people getting cancer and miscarriages and all that. You have to deal with it. And even if, we're just a technology company, we've just got computers, then you've got one hell of an environmental problem, because computers are a hazardous waste if you get rid of them. And all that wiring that makes our buildings run, when we take down these buildings now and tear them down, that wiring, those computer networks nodes, those are environmental hazards. And so in the salvage value, you have to take into account the fact that you've got problems that are going to have to be remediated. If you plan at the beginning for it, then when the project is closing down, those people there at the end are going to open up and they're going to bless you. You've given them the roadmap at the end of the story. But if you ignore it, they are going to come and piss on your graves for what you left them to deal with. You see, that's why you face the salvage values early. And that's because you are going to be the bosses, the leaders, the managers. I'm telling you this so that you go out there and you say, let's deal with it now so that our kids don't have to deal with what our people right now are dealing with. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.